We finished up the rapture last week. Woohoo! That was eye-opening. And today we get back to John's vision in Revelation. When we left off, a red dragon stood upon the sands of the sea and called forth a terrible beast. We'd just been told in chapter 12 that this red dragon is the spiritual view of Satan. It's red and has horns and is probably where our modern image of Satan comes from. As for the beast, one of its heads looks like it received a fatal wound, but the fatal wound has been healed. So, in a twisted sense, it's sort of been resurrected. The whole world is amazed by this beast and worships it, and also worships the dragon because of this incredible miracle. In chapter 13, the beast is called from the sea. Whereas in the spiral about the beast, back in chapter 11, John says he is from the abyss. Now, both of these are spiritual views. We know this because they're both about the beast, who in real life is the boastful ruler that rules during the tribulation. The only difference in these two spiritual views is that one is in the spiral about the two witnesses, and the other is in the spiral that gives the beast's backstory. And that means that John is equating the abyss with the sea. Spiritually speaking, this will become important later. For the moment, put this factoid on a shelf while we continue the story. Now, if we compare Revelation to Daniel's prophecies, we find that Daniel also has a great deal to say about a boastful ruler who arises in the end times. Now, Daniel is way back pre-Christ, okay? He's back from the Babylonian captivity is when he was writing. Daniel 8:22 tells us the ruler that arises is from the remains of the four pieces that the Greek Empire splits into after the death of Alexander the Great. And if you know your history, you know that the Greek Empire came after the Babylonian Empire. So how is Daniel writing about Alexander the Great? And that's why scholars think Daniel was probably written in retrospect from around 165 BCE, looking back through from the Roman Empire, back through the Greek Empire, and back to the Babylonian Empire. So that's just an FYI. Anyway, this ruler that Daniel sees arises grows from to the east and the south, which is exactly what the Roman Empire does. He will have a fierce face and will understand dark sayings and enigmas. The meaning here is hard to figure out, so most modern translations say he is skilled in intrigue. He will excel in destruction, ruin, and corruption. He will thrive, but will ruin the powerful, as well as bringing destruction to God's people. Through his cunning, he will champion deceitfulness, and in his heart, he will magnify and promote himself. He will even stand against the prince of princes, but he will ultimately be destroyed and not by human hands. Standing against the prince of princes, that would be standing against the Messiah, right? Well, Daniel's prophecy in chapter 11 adds more detail to this. In a nutshell, Daniel shows this ruler as being constantly at war and, quote, at the appointed time, which we know is how Hebrew prophets flag end time prophecies, at the appointed time, this ruler will suffer a defeat in the south, which in Daniel's context would refer to Egypt or a nation south of Israel. This defeat makes this ruler so mad, he desecrates the temple fortress, stops the daily sacrifices, and sets up the abomination that causes desolation that Jesus talks about. And apparently, lots of folks get scared and abandon their faith, and this ruler flatters them for it. It's a time of severe persecution. But John says, those who know God stand strong. Well, the ruler continues to do as he pleases and will exalt and promote himself above every god, including Yahweh, uttering blasphemies as he does it. He ends up conquering pretty much everyone and gathering great riches to himself. But, Daniel prophesies, no one comes to help him when his own end comes. Now, this is all in Daniel, and it dovetails precisely with John's beast in Revelation, probably because this is the pillar John is building his story around. This ruler is popularly called the Antichrist. Well, it will probably come as no surprise to you that the only reference to an Antichrist is by John. And it's in the tiny epistles attributed to him near the end of the New Testament. In 1st and 2nd John is where he talks about it. And even there, he saw the Antichrist as typical of anyone lying and opposing Christ. He says, you have heard Antichrist is coming. He doesn't say the Antichrist. He just says Antichrist. You have heard Antichrist is coming. But even now, many Antichrists have come. And then a few verses later, he says, the Antichrist, is the one rejecting the Father and the Son. Now, that's a pretty broad statement, and it would not apply to just one single person in history, right? Exactly. Even John goes on to say that every spirit that does not agree that Jesus Messiah has come in the flesh is the spirit of the Antichrist. And in his next letter, John says, there are many such deceivers in the world. This is the Antichrist. So even John was not thinking a single Antichrist so much as there being a spirit of opposition to Christ at work in many people in the world. But the idea took root, and thus we have the notion that there is a particular Antichrist in the end time, and that this boastful, narcissistic ruler described in Revelation and in Daniel, this spiritual beast, is the Antichrist, even though that term is not used by John in Revelation anywhere. But there's still one detail to address, and that is that in Revelation 11, John says the beast that comes from the abyss kills the two witnesses at the 3.5-year point. Now, I want to point out that John does not say the beast comes from the abyss at the 3.5-year point. He just identifies him as being the beast from the abyss. And based on the prophecies in Daniel, we know that this beast, this king, this ruler, whatever, the Antichrist, makes a covenant with, quote, the many at the beginning of the 70th seven and then breaks it after the first 3.5 years. So to be in a position to do all these things, this ruler, the Antichrist, actually arises quite some time before the 70th seven. Daniel prophesies several wars and intrigues this ruler is involved in before the 70th seven, in fact. So what happens next? John sees a second beast. This is a new one. This one arising from the earth. The first beast arose from the sea, which we later found out was the abyss. But this one comes from the earth. It has two horns like a lamb, but it speaks like a dragon. Now, we already know that the first beast had a fatal wound that was healed, and so all the people worshiped the first beast in a twisted mimicry of the resurrection of Jesus. And I think the horns on this new beast are not meant to represent kings like they normally would be, but are part of intentionally describing this second beast as looking like a lamb. It's no accident that it looks like a lamb, and it's no accident it speaks like a dragon. He looks like Jesus, but speaks twisted lies like Satan, the red dragon. Now, this second beast is the mouthpiece of the first beast and acts with its full authority. It makes the earth and its people worship the first beast. And it even does great miracles, including making fire come down from heaven. And everyone is deceived by this second beast. Later in Revelation, John begins to call this second beast the false prophet. Now, the false prophet says to the people, "Make an image of the beast who had the death wound and has lived." And when they do, the false prophet gives it breath, animates it so it can speak. Now, in bygone eras, this sounded very outlandish. Not so outlandish nowadays, right? We have the technology now to do exactly this. John says anyone who refuses to worship the image of the beast is killed. The false prophet also gives everyone a mark, a stamp, or an engraving, perhaps a tattoo, the word could mean any of these things, on their right hand or their forehead. And no one can buy or sell unless they have that mark, either the name of the beast or the number of its name, which is 666, the number of a man. Well, as you well know, there is a lot of speculation about what the name behind this number might be. Various language traditions typically assign a number to each letter of their alphabet. This is called gematria. So, for example, in English, we'd say A would be one, B would be two, and so on. So, the first question you'd want to ask is, which language are we talking about? Greek? That's the language John is writing in. Hebrew? Well, maybe. Do we transliterate the name from Greek to Hebrew, basically converting each Greek letter to a Hebrew letter rather than using what the name would be in Hebrew, the language Hebrew? Then you'd want to ask, well, should we include the beast title like king or Caesar or emperor or so and so? And depending on how you answer these questions, you can come up with many different answers. So the bottom line is that John didn't give us enough information to know. So don't get bamboozled by someone who gives you a definite answer as to what the name 666 stands for. All we know is that the Antichrist is a human. John likely believed it to be a Roman emperor, but even so, you can come up with different emperors around this time period using different combinations of titles and names. So, if you want a great discussion of this, look up the video "Why 666 in the Bible Can't Refer to Nero" by Dr. Peter Goman of the Bible Sojourner on YouTube. Anyway, chapter 14 begins with another pause in heaven. So we know we're starting another spiral in John's story. We're about to get some new information. John sees the lamb, not the false prophet, but real lamb, Jesus, the lamb that was truly slain, standing on Mount Zion. And with him are those 144,000 from the 12 tribes of Israel who have the name of God written on their foreheads. John hears a loud roar like crashing waves or peals of thunder, but at the same time, that roar is as musical as harps. The 144,000 sing a new song before God, the 24 elders, and the cherubim. John says no one else can learn this new song except the 144,000. And then he describes them. These 144,000, he says, are the ones who have not polluted themselves with women. They are virgins. Got a bit of patriarchy going on here. They accompany the Lamb wherever he goes. They have been redeemed from among men as the first fruits to God and to the Lamb. No lie is found in their mouth. They are blameless before God. Now, we first saw this exact scene back in chapter 7, and I explained then that I interpret the 144,000 as the heavenly spiritual view of Israel. You can interpret it several different ways. And here we see that whoever these are, they are redeemed from the world and made spotless and pure. Now, next, John sees an angel flying and proclaiming the everlasting good news to every people and every nation on earth. The angel proclaims, "Fear God and give him glory, because the hour of his judgment has come." And a second angel cries, "Babylon the Great has fallen, the one who made all the nations drink the wine of the wrath, anger, indignation of her porneus." Now that word is an old familiar one that is usually translated as sexual immorality in scripture, and it's often specifically associated with idolatry. Now, Babylon was the name of the city where the Jews were taken and enslaved when Judah fell back in 722 BCE. That literal physical city of Babylon was their final destroyer. So what city would spiritually be Babylon the Great in John's context here in Revelation? Well, what city in John's time forces nations to drink of her idolatry, specifically her state-mandated emperor worship, which God would see as sexual adultery against him? God has always viewed Israel as a spouse. What city is doing this? Rome, of course, the capital city of the empire, the seat of the emperors that are to be worshipped. So this is all John says about Babylon the Great for now in this spiral. We're going to get more details in a later spiral. The wine of wrath, I think, is the wine of God's wrath towards this idolatry. This is borne out by the message of the next angel. The third angel cries, "Anyone who worships the beast and its image and receives its mark, they too will drink the wine of God's anger, which has been poured full strength into this cup." Now that makes sense. Anyone who worships the beast or its image so they can buy and sell is worshiping money, riches, and power instead of God, right? People apparently can choose to refuse the mark, even though it means certain starvation. John is making the choice quite clear for his seven churches. He is saying, don't choose Rome. Don't choose the so-called safety of money and riches. Don't choose commerce. Remain steadfast in God. Then John goes on, full on apocalyptic here. This angel gets specific about what the wine of God's anger looks like. He proclaims, "Anyone who worships the beast and its image will be tortured in fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the Lamb. The smoke of their torture goes up forever and ever, and they will have no rest day or night." Yikes! That sounds a lot more like writing and imagery typical in the apocalyptic genre than anything whatsoever like how God and Jesus treat people, even bad people. I think John is mindful of his audience. They are facing temptation to conform to the demands of Rome, to go along to get along. It's not only a serious economic choice, but it may literally be a life or death choice for them at this moment in their lives. And John is very, very forceful about the spiritual consequences of choosing human power and protection over God's. So this is a good time to remind ourselves we need to lash ourselves to the mast of Jesus when we read Revelation. We need to keep in mind it was considered iffy at best when the Christian canon was being decided. We need to take the point without getting hung up trying to take typical ancient apocalyptic imagery literally. It's not supposed to be taken literally, not even in John's day. So then John hears a voice from heaven saying, "Write this down. Blessed are those who die from now on. The Spirit says they will rest from their labor and their works will follow them." Now that totally tracks with the idea that our works in the kingdom here on earth follow us in the sense of being recorded in the book of life for our future reward. Now, John sees a man, not an angel, seated on a cloud. A golden laurel crown is on his head, and a sharp sickle is in his hand. An angel comes out of the temple there in heaven and tells the man, "Reap the earth, because the harvest is ripe." And so the man begins swinging his sickle. This happens a second time when another angel comes out of the temple in heaven and he has a sickle. Then another angel, the one in charge of the fire at the altar, calls out, "Harvest the clusters from earth's vine because its grapes are ripe," which in context means that evil has finally come to its full fruition. This, of course, is the spiritual view of what is happening. The angel throws the grapes he harvests into the winepress of God's great wrath. Now, my Bible says he throws them into the great winepress of God's wrath. But unless I'm misreading the genders of the adjective and nouns in the original Greek, what is great is not the winepress, but God's wrath. The earthly physical result is that the blood flows as high as horses' bridles for 180 miles around. Now, presumably, this is 180 miles around Jerusalem, possibly Rome, both of which occupy center stage in Revelation. I think this is probably John's first spiral to touch on Armageddon and the battle for Jerusalem. He's going to give us more detail in a later spiral, so we're just going to remember this for now. Going to put a pin in this spiral and wait for the spiral where John gives us enough detail to figure this part out. We know another spiral is starting, though, because next, John sees another great sign in heaven. That's our marker to know we finished one spiral and are starting another one. This is the last sign, John says, because with it, God's wrath is finished, completed, it ends. John sees what looks like a sea of glass, and standing beside it are those who came through the tribulation and did not submit to the beast, its image, nor the number of its name. They hold harps given to them by God, and they sing the song of Moses and of the Lamb. And sure enough, the song John writes down is a mashup of songs and psalms from the Hebrew Bible, including the song of Moses in Exodus 15. They sing, "Great and marvelous are your works, Lord God Almighty. Just and true are your ways, O King of all people. Who would neither fear nor glorify your name? For you alone are holy. All nations will come and worship in your presence because your righteous and just acts have been revealed." And as John looks, he sees the tabernacle of the testimony in the temple thrown open. Now, this is interesting phrasing, since this is what the old tent-like tabernacle used to be called in the Hebrew Bible. Now, the temple long ago replaced that old tabernacle that the Hebrews hauled around the wilderness before they entered the promised land. But apparently, that old original tabernacle is at the heart of the temple in heaven, at least in John's vision. Out of the temple come seven angels with seven plagues. They are dressed in linen pure and bright, with sashes of gold around their chests. Then one of the cherubim gives the seven angels golden bowls filled with the wrath of the God who lives forever. And the temple is filled with smoke from the glory and power of God, and no one is able to enter the temple until the angels have completed these seven plagues. And John hears a great voice from the temple saying, "Go, pour the seven bowls of wrath into the earth." The first angel pours his bowl on the land, and those who had the mark of the beast and worshipped his image break out with evil, malicious sores. So you see, what's happening in heaven is a bowl of wrath is being poured out, and then John is telling us what is happening on earth as a result. The second angel pours his bowl on the sea, this being the actual literal ocean, since this whole passage is describing the physical impact on the earth. The sea turns to blood, and not just blood, but blood that is dead, and everything in the sea dies. The third angel pours his bowl on the fresh waters, and they too become blood. The angel of the waters cries out, "You are just in your judgment, O Holy One, for they shed the blood of your prophets and your people, so you have given them blood to drink." And the altar in heaven speaks up and says, "Yes, Lord God Almighty, true and just are your judgments." So you see, everything in heaven is animated with life, even what we would think would be an inanimate object. There is nothing but life in heaven. The fourth angel pours his bowl on the sun, and the people are scorched by intense heat. But instead of repenting and honoring God, they curse his name. The fifth angel pours his bowl upon the throne of the beast, the Antichrist, and its kingdom is plunged into darkness. People gnaw their tongues in agony because of their distress, but still they blaspheme God because of their pain and their sores, and they refuse to repent of their works. The sixth angel pours his bowl over the river Euphrates, and its water dries up, John says, to prepare the way for the kings of the east to come. The Antichrist, the beast, and his false prophet see an opportunity to gather reinforcements from the east and the west, and they get busy doing just that. Little do they know that God is luring them into a trap. I want to remind you that the Antichrist and his false prophet are two men. The red dragon is Satan. What you are seeing in this next part is the spiritual view of them. We know that because he's describing them in these spiritual ways. So as John watches, three frogs come from each of their mouths. The frog, and he says, these frogs are demonic spirits that perform miracles. They are sent to all the kings of the earth to gather them together in battle against the Lord God Almighty. Now here's the world as it looked around the time of Revelation. This was the world to them. This is the Euphrates River, that if you can see that red dotted line. It, along with the desert, have given that, you know, all that yellow part, have given Israel a natural defense against the kingdoms of the north and the east for millennia, funneling any attacking armies through the relatively narrow channel that Israel could defend. But now the Euphrates dries up, and the kingdoms from the north and the east can easily pour through. Kings from the south can still make their way up the coast until they hit a mountain pass named Megiddo. Now, Megiddo is a small mountain located in the middle of the huge plain of Jezreel, just north and west of Jerusalem. Mountain in Hebrew is Har. The English transliteration of this Mount Megiddo is therefore Har Megiddo, Armageddon. Although the pass behind Armageddon is easily defended, the rest of the approaches are not. Here is a modern aerial view. You can see that the mountain is more of a hill from which there is a clear view across the enormous Jezreel Valley, and south of it is the pass. It is to this huge plain that the kings of the world are induced to gather by those miracle-performing demonic frogs sent from the mouths of Satan, the Antichrist, and his false prophet. John just told us that the seventh bowl of plagues will be the end of God's wrath, And we know the Battle of Armageddon will be the final battle, the one where God shows up and Jesus comes the second time. So it's no surprise that once the kings are gathered, John sees the seventh angel pour the seventh bowl and cry out, "It is done." And there are flashes of lightning and voices of thunder, and there is an earthquake such has never happened since men have walked the earth. The great city, which is one of John's nicknames for Rome, is split into three parts, and the cities of the nations fall. God remembers Babylon the Great and gives her the wine cup filled with the fury of his wrath. Mountains and islands are flattened, and huge 100-pound hailstorms fall on people, and still they blaspheme God because this plague is so terrible. Now, that's a good place to stop for today. John's not quite finished with this spiral. Based on where he went with this, it looks like John's earlier description of blood flowing as high as horses' bridles is a description of what will happen at Armageddon. But that is all part and parcel of the fall of Babylon the Great, which we'll get to next. John's going to tell us all about that next week. But for now, let's go into our breakout groups and consider the choices people are making in this story. We've had a lot of over-the-top imagery in this story, lots of good guy versus bad guy stuff. And I think that's because John is trying to make the choice these churches need to make crystal clear. It is not a small choice. I want us to look at all of this through this lens of decision-making. What choices do people have, and what are the consequences of those choices? So in your handout, the study guide, in the study guide, I'm giving you kind of a visual overview of what we've covered so far. But the questions have to do with, so what do we do with this? What does this have to do with decision making? So you don't have to read everything on there. Go straight to the questions. All right. So there was a lot visually going on here. And I hope I didn't confuse you, but like I said, the whole point was to talk about, you know, what choices do people have in these situations and what difference does it make, all the things. So what do you think?
Marlene's gonna go.
Oh, it's Marlene's turn. Okay.
She's been chosen
so nicely for all of us.
Yeah,
Joe too.
Basically, what we were talking about is, if you look at history, and there are these many, many, many times when there are people in power who will sacrifice anything to stay in power. And then there is the personal choice, you know, do you stand with the powerful or do you stay true to God? We see it today in modern America. We have seen it in the past many, many, many times. And so for believers, in your second question, even if believers choose to stick with God and not take the mark of the beast or whatever the imagery is, we're still going to be here and we're still going to suffer the consequences of those choices. And then our choice is, how do we act as people of God in that situation? Are we trying to help? Are we trying to support? Are we still trying to point to God? Or are we joining those that are cursing God and just scrambling for whatever we can get? And so the choice is a personal choice. Yeah. Go with the power, that the earthly power, or go with God.
Yeah. Yeah. And it seems, you know, the choice feels easy sitting where we are.
Yes.
I'm not so sure the choice will be easy in the moment, when there's no food and no water and it's our kids and our grandkids, right?
Right. Well, yeah. And that was something I would point out, because we're talking about the extreme times of resistance that we've seen, you know, what we study in history. And that's what I said, I don't think it even has to be extreme. There's always suffering somewhere. And but we're, you know, they're, and I said, because we always think that we're going to suffer, but they're suffering too in the end with this, right? So it's the same as last week. Every day you practice who you're going to be. But
We,
for me, it
oh, go ahead.
concerns me that, sorry, that there's a lot of people that aren't choosing anything right now.
Yeah,
Oh, that
that's
stresses
the
me out. I'm not going
danger.
to choose
You know,
it.
I think that's what John was getting at with, was it Laodicea, who was lukewarm, neither hot nor cold? I think that is what he's trying to get to.
Yeah, because that's also a choice.
Yes, that's the thing I
Yep.
said. Even not choosing is a choice, right?
We kind of agreed with that in our group, but I'm going to call out Martha and ask her to please share her thoughts about Jesus in this. And we had agreed that, you know, throughout history, people have tried to see the end times and what's the point we have today? We don't even know about tomorrow. What can we do today? And so how, and also Lumar pointed out these questions are present tense. What choices do the kings and the wicked of the earth have? How do their choices affect believers? What choices do believers have? And we focused on things with that tense in mind because we can do nothing about the past. We can do nothing about the future. We have today and how we live today. And I shared a story, but Martha really tapped into something beautiful.
When I took my Disciple Bible class, it was just a few sessions in, when it occurred to me that all of the stories of the broken covenant were actually stories of hope. God would make an agreement with God's people, things would be great, people would forget the covenant or break the covenant, God would sigh and say, "Shall we try again?" They would make a new covenant, make a new agreement. At some point, it would fall apart. He did this with nations and he did this with individuals over and over again. God always comes back and God's not keeping score. When Jesus and Peter meet after the resurrection, Jesus
This is
in
after Peter has denied him three times.
Exactly, that's where I'm going. Yep, P
Yeah.
Peter had denied him three times, and I heard, "Do you love me?" as a rebuke for many years. But you've got to prove yourself to me.
Yes.
And there were three denials and three "Do you love me's," and I look at that now as each of those pairings was Jesus providing healing and hope for Peter.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
And that God is not keeping score in the way it looks like God is in Revelation. And all of salvation history does not, to me, point to Revelation.
It does not.
No.
Right.
And that it was something Julia said that made me think about oh, this not keeping score anymore business for her personally. Made me think of, well, wait a minute. If God's not keeping score and we're made in the image and likeness of God, our capacity when we can to not keep score is a reflection of who we were made to be in the image and likeness of God.
That's beautiful.
Yes.
Yeah.
And
You know,
it's
you made a comment though about being counted, and that makes that. Why do so many religions have counts then?
counts as in
Well,
you've
some
done too many
religions,
wrong things.
only this amount of people are going to be saved, or you
Oh.
have to be this to be saved. Nobody else is going to be. I mean, there's a lot of it, not a little bit.
No more.
Yeah, that seems like a very human thing. I think we do have a tendency to want to be in the in crowd and to exclude somebody.
Yeah, we
Oh, we
lost.
lost Joe. hopefully she'll come back.
We do that from the time we are choosing sides for the kickball team in elementary school.
It seems to be a human character flaw. The, you know, and I guess it goes back to, you know your enemies and beware of them, but it just seeps into every aspect of our social interactions and
And I
institutions.
forgot the reminder of
Yeah.
I forgot how much I like that game.
I used to love that game. Oh, here comes Jo. She's coming back.
I'm sorry. Yeah, I don't know what happened.
That's okay. You want to continue your comment, Martha and Marlene, to answer Joe's. She was asking about counts.
I think the only thing that I would add to that is the possibility that that was, if you're with the in group, you have a better chance to survive. And so perhaps it's not so much a human weakness to want that, but a reflection of if you couldn't stay with the group on the good side and they said, can't deal with this person anymore, they've got to stay behind because they are going to kill the rest of us. Back into early human history, I wonder
Survival.
if the message of that.
Oh, that's really good. And that I would like to relate that spiritually to what Martha was saying earlier. This is a core concept that I hope you've picked up on, but I want to reiterate that. And that is in these moments of crisis, when things are overwhelming and are too much for us, when we want to count, when it's just too much, the answer is not to enclose. The answer is not to inflate yourself. The answer is not to build a wall. The answer is to efface yourself. The answer is to face towards God and efface yourself and let God through. All right. That is where the power is. That is where the life is. That is where you will find the strength to survive these moments and to do the right thing, because what is right will be God doing it, because you have just opened this conduit, okay? But and we practice that. We practice doing that now. That's not something you learn in a crisis moment. It doesn't mean you're losing your identity. It actually means becoming who you are truly meant to be. You are meant to be a God conduit. All right. That's the whole point. So anyway, that's my view of those things.
Yeah, that kind of supports what you were saying in our breakout group, Joe, that what we are doing today, we are practicing what we will do in the time of crisis, the choices we make every day. And Julie, you said that too. The choices that we make in situations today is building that muscle for when the big challenges come.
And it's also becoming comfortable with the fact that God does show up. It's getting practice with God showing up in these smaller ways. And with how do you handle it if it felt like God didn't show up?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. You know, the essence of what John was saying was that even the righteous are going to suffer.
Yeah, it's going to feel
And
like God went somewhere else.
You're not exempt from it.
yeah, and that is a time when rather than say, God, where are you, is saying, God, where should I be?
Yes.
And
Oh, I love that.
no.
I have to write that down. Hang on.
And I think when I say what concerns me about the amount of people that are choosing to not make a choice today, because what that means is chaos.
Yeah.
That means chaos.
Yeah.
And we're seeing that a lot in the
always
world.
been that way. It's always been that way.
Yeah.
Because, like I said in our breakup group, think back of all the good things done in the name of God that were horrific. The Spanish Inquisitions, the wars.
The decrees that for slavery in the New World.
Yeah, but I
that was done in by people really believing they were in the right.
Yeah.
And doing what was best, but no, it's not a core. And when you look in the Bible and you see love your neighbor as yourself, how can you do these atrocities, you know?
It doesn't, the Crusades don't feel like that. Slavery doesn't feel like that. The Inquisition doesn't feel like, you know, like mm-hmm. these are not fruits of the Spirit. All you had to do was look at the fruit, and you could have seen the fruit ahead of time on these things.
Yeah. And the pogroms by the church against the Jews in Europe.
Joe, did you get to say what you wanted to say?
Me? Thank you. I was going to say, I actually meant the chaos of not knowing what to do. I remember way back when, I mean, I was a kid, the movies about the big boat that was sinking and everybody was trying to get off of it. And
Poseidon Adventure.
Yes. And then the Towering Inferno.
Yes.
And in both of them, what's clear is the people that had a level head and were looking for ways to get out, or the ones who got out, everybody else was in chaos.
Yes. Yep. And one scene in particular has stuck with me my entire life, and I think of it often. And it is of the team in Poseidon Adventure trying to escape this boat, small team, and they have one really overweight woman who they are dragging like a ball and chain.
Yes.
And they choose to slow down and stay with her. They choose to stay together. And in the end, they encounter a place where they need a swimmer. I'm tearing up at this. And it turns out she was a champion swimmer when she was young, and she saved them all at the last minute by carrying them through the water.
Yeah.
We choose each other. God's going to work the rest of it out.
And if I had been her, I would have said, y'all go on. I'm holding you down. Right. Yeah. But so that's what I'm saying.
Yes.
Exactly. Those movies have stuck with me because I'm not the level-headed one that looks at my friend Anne is. She's, you know, scanning doors and stuff when we sit in places. And I don't think that. But that has stuck with me. And so in the end, we're going to be stuck, no matter where we're choosing, we're going to be stuck in amidst a lot of chaos. And in that moment, again, we're going to have to choose in the chaos. And that's what bothers me about people not choosing now. Gail, are you okay?
Damn, it's just, this is so deep to me. And that was such a transformational moment for me when I was young when that movie came out.
Yeah.
And Joe, you have a village that won't leave you behind. There are so many people that care about you.
Oh, I thank you, Julia. I'm not questioning that. I'm questioning you that if I was in a group of strangers and I was the one holding them back, that I know I would say, you go. And if they insisted to take me along, I'd go.
But what I'm saying is, even with your not being the one that's calm and all that, you have people that just see your fruit and care about you.
That's very kind, Julia. Thank you.
But that's an important point. Oh my goodness, I'm glad you brought that up, Julia. Because we are not all designed by God to be the leader and the one that people coalesce around in these moments.
Right.
You are not called to be that. You are called to be you and to let God help you be you. That's what will help in these moments. God knows that you're the swimmer. not the leader.
Yeah, good point, Julia. Thank you. I thought that you thought I was saying, oh, I'm going to get left behind. No, I was saying
no.
I wouldn't want that. But no, that's very beautiful. That's very beautiful.
But it's the things you do and the relationships you cultivate and the way you are that make other people want to be there for you.
Yeah. Understood. And I agree.
All,
thank you.
All of us have that opportunity, but I know you personally.
Oh,
Brian, were you going to say something? I saw green light up around your image.
Yeah, no, I was just pondering it all.
I did see Anne with her hand up earlier.
Brian started to say a little more, though. What were you going to say, Brian?
Oh, I'm sorry, Martha. Sorry, Brian.
Well, I kind of think about the old Bob Dylan song, everyone's going to have to serve somebody. It might be the devil or it might be the Lord. So hopefully more will choose the Lord.
Yeah. Look at you.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah. All right, Miss Ian.
So I have a couple of comments. Number one is it really perturbed me when they said, you know, the ones that are saved are those who are not polluted by women. Really, bro? Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Should be a red flag right there that we're not, you know, this is, you know, definitely got some cultural guilt on the edge of it.
Exactly. So I'm still kind of pissed off about that. Secondly, I may have to leave early to get a tattoo on my forehead, but I'm not sure. Should I tattoo the word God or Jesus? Which of those is the acceptable routine?
Perhaps Yahweh.
There you go.
True enough. True enough.
Yeah. Yeah, that's funny.
Y'all are hilarious.
And, oh,
y'all are
well, hilarious. And you did, you know, Gail, I was thinking the whole time, it's real easy to martyr oneself, to be, yo, I'm going to be the strong one. But when your kids are starving,
mm-hmm.
that makes a huge difference.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
you have to prepare for it. You have to have already put their mm-hmm. lives on the altar. You have to have yep. already released their lives as well.
Easier said than done.
Go
ahead, Martha. You're saying, whoa. Yep.
So I'm not going to criticize any mother or father or older sibling who steals to feed a child. I'm not.
Oh, no, that's not what I'm talking about. Yeah, not at all.
But what you said was to put the be willing to put the child on the altar.
What I mean is that I have to be willing to not worship money and power, not to succumb to money and power.
Right.
Order to quote save my children.
You know, I've
that's
already
a different
made up,
thing than stealing a loaf, you know, stealing food.
And that's,
I've already made up my mind that if it, you know, they said deny Christ and you can have this food or whatnot, or you know, if you won't deny Christ, we're going to kill you. I've already made up my mind. You know, that's I'll give up my life for Christ. But if what if they said, if you don't deny Christ, we're going to kill your granddaughter, Emily.
Right.
That's a different story.
Yeah.
That's and just, I hadn't really thought about
think
that.
About. We have to think about them mm-hmm. now. Marlene.
When you said that, Gail, about not putting our children on the altar or putting our children on the altar, that immediately brought the image of Abraham and Isaac mm-hmm. to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I wonder why that story is in the Bible. That Abraham trusted God right up to the last minute. And even when it looked like God was going to have him go through with it, he still was ready to do that and kept saying, God will provide. And not to say that we would expect that our children would not starve to death, but that level of trust that Abraham showed in God to the point of having the knife over his son's chest is very evocative for me, that I need to trust that whatever happens, my daughters will be in God's hands.
I think this
either
is
in this life or the next.
I think this is more of a bigger package of how I need to be standing as mother in relation to my children.
Sure. Anyway,
okay.
Yeah.
Those children belong to God. I am here for support. I am here for assistance. But when we're in a crisis, I am here to show them how we remain faithful and walk through this crisis together.
So, can I share a quick story? And I hope Anne doesn't mind. 3 days after Uvalde happened, the school she was teaching at went into a lockdown over an active shooter. Anne texts me. So I know she's like, active shooter, not a drill. And then she tells me, get on the police scanner. I'm like, oh yeah, I have that handy. So, but she did. But the police go through when they do these lockdowns and there's a potential, active shooter. They clear every room. So Anne is in an odd classroom. She's in like one of these outdoor tech buildings that have, you know, the doors with the push bars. They're not like regular classrooms. And she has shoved, in addition to locking, she's shoved something in the bar so that it can't be opened either way. And the police come, they're doing the stuff, and she's not letting them in. And she starts, then she gets a message from the office that says, Anne, the police are at your door trying to get in. And so, you know, so at that point she opened it and she did. So when I tell you that Anne is the leader I want to be with when something happens on, you know, the Towering Inferno, she's also that protector because she did some amazing, amazing things in that time with her kids. And
that's good. Day, that's good stuff, yeah, right?
Yes. No, and no, I meant like, you know, she made a makeshift bathroom. She did, right? But I don't have 5-gallon buckets in my classroom. So there you go. But in the end, the next day, the principal was chastising her about it. And she said, I will never apologize for keeping my kids safe. And miraculously, I guess at the right time, Anne, correct me if I'm wrong, but the vice principal came through and said, what are you talking about? Everybody in the building wanted to be in her class. They knew it was going to be impenetrable.
Yeah.
So in those moments, you know, now I'm going to cry. You aren't just a leader. You protected those kids. Yeah. And so I know who you'll be.
Yeah.
Well, I'm still perturbed about the polluted with women comment.
I know,
saying.
Okay, well, what the irony is in that is that we currently have people getting away with that because they're in power.
Martha, I saw your hand go up. Yeah, I saw your hand go up, Martha.
I really appreciate the image that you put around kind of what you meant when you said putting children on the altar. What I see is a difference between, so I think there's a greediness of my children over anybody else's children happens. And that to me is putting them on an altar, not a sacrificial altar.
Right.
Right.
And I think that's a pretty dangerous thing. And I think I can't put a, I had a thought about Abraham being willing to sacrifice Isaac that I think is that I can't come up with, but I think I will probably always be troubled with the idea that God would ask a father to do that and the father be willing to do that.
Can I just say, and I don't think you were in the class, in that class series, but did we lose you? Okay, there you are. I think what was going on there was that it was a thing in that ancient culture for there to be child sacrifice in order for there to be rain or things that were necessarily in.
So there was something desperate
in there. It was yes, and it was a it was your sacrifice of last resort, and that was being carried in the hearts and the understanding of the people, of God's people. And God was saying, okay, we're going to do an object lesson here. Let's go do this. And I'm going to show you that I am not that kind of God.
I'm not going to accept that sacrifice.
That is not acceptable to me. And then God was very explicit about that in other places in the Hebrew Bible, very explicit about how that was never, ever acceptable. And in fact, the valley, Gehinnom, outside of Jerusalem, is where child sacrifice did tend to get made. One of the worst idols was Molech, I think. And there were several idols, but that was where child sacrifice tended to happen. And God particularly hated that physical place because of it. And that valley of Gehinnom is Gehenna, the trash heap of Jerusalem that Jesus talks about when he talks about those fires.
Yeah. Julia's got her hand up.
Julia.
Yeah, I do. I'm thinking back to what Anne said, being upset about the virgins and the polluted by women. And when I heard that, and every time I hear that, I think there's other religions that focus on the virgins too. And that religion, both of these situations, this book and that other religion, are the results of a revelation through dreams. And I'm thinking, do these people just dream about these virgins all the time? What is the obsession? You know? That's all I'm going to say.
I can neither explain nor defend any of the above.
Out of hope. Oh my gosh.
I have some rabbit trail thoughts, but they would take us totally off topic.
Oh man, I wish we had
maybe I'll put it on the Facebook page.
Okay, that's the place for it, is in the discussion group. We can continue.
Okay, so speaking of, we wish we had a lot more time, Gail.
Yes, ma'am.
We know we are very near the end of
this. We have two more classes.
Two more. And
then our celebration. Mm-hmm.
And the celebration is going to be an online where everybody is there.
Yes.
Well, there are some folks, you know, I'm in Chicago, but there's some local folks who may be able to arrange a physical get together if you would.
Of course. I would love that. I would love that.
We want to be able to celebrate our time together and all we've learned and all that you have done to make that possible. Of course.
And I would love to celebrate you for listening to all these hours of me talking. Oh my goodness. and for your courage and the change. And so, yeah, absolutely. When we do in 3 weeks on the 10th, when we do our online celebration, feel free to have prepared something, to have something to say. You know, I'll have a few things, just a couple of things that I want to share or say, and it's just going to be a free for all. So it's just a time to get together and to celebrate together. So that will be.
Yeah, but I think she's referring to, we don't want to, that some people don't want to do it just on Zoom. They want to get together.
That's fine.
With you and the others.
That would be fine. I'm for all of the above. So.
Well, you'll hear from some of the local people.
Okay, that sounds great.
Do a few things.
Gail's house.
What'd you say?
Party at Gail's house.
Party at Gail's house. Anytime. Anytime. All right. I love you. We'll see you next week. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye. Thank you.